a production of South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
That covers everything. Okay, we should be on.
Okay. Call this October 25th, 2011 meeting of the Executive Board to order. I want to welcome the members of the board back. I think I saw most of you yesterday. And to those of you sitting in the audience here today, and to everyone who's listening to us on the internet. And with that, we've got a fairly light schedule today. I hope that we're finished with it and everybody's out of here by 12 o'clock. So if you'll cooperate, and we'll just get right to the order of business at this time. Would the secretary please call a roll?
Senator Frey.
Here.
Hunstead,
I'm here. If it's okay with you, I'll hear this, Amanda.
Tiedemann,
too.
Representatives
Abdallah, Tyson,
here.
Ponset,
here.
Feinstein, Lucas,
here.
Rausch, Benner, Vice Chair Cutler,
here.
And Chair Cutler.
Chair Turbeville. we're both here. All right, we do have a quorum. And at this time, I'd ask for approval of the minutes of the August 22nd meeting. I believe everyone should have a copy of those. Motion, please. Second by Representative Lucas. Any questions or comments? If not, all those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Approval of the agenda. Seated before you, do you have any questions, comments, or additions? Yes. Representative Carson.
I'd like to make an addition to the agenda today. Jason Dill just needs to come, or has been summoned to come up and speak before us about the transportation issue.
All right. If the board's agreeable to that, we'll make that addition. And how about if we... if Mr. Jill just can be here probably about 9 o'clock, have you got any time scheduled for him?
That's the time I have that he's scheduled to be here, sir.
Okay. We'll make that addition to the agenda. Are there any other additions, Representative Lucas?
Just to ask maybe Director Frey, do we have any plans then for any legislator training on the governor's budget address day, if we needed to look into that or not?
We have really dispensed with that. That was something that they did before, but at this point, there is nothing really burning right now that we're aware of that would, that would lend itself to a training session on that day. We've got committee meetings scheduled for that day and several other things. So the tradition over the last couple of years, we've kind of filled it up with other things. We can certainly do that if someone has a good idea, though. We'd be more than willing to contact CSG or NCSL and see if there's something that would be of value. So if any members of the board has an idea and they would like to see that happen, we can get it done. But right now, we're not aware of anything pressing and available to us. So.
Anything else? Senator Teason.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to add, under the subcommittee report on interns, reconsideration of the number of interns for the legislature for the upcoming session.
Okay. Representative Abdallah.
I have a question, probably for Senator Teason. What's the procedure for selecting interns? I mean, where does it go next?
Would you like me to answer that now, or would you like me to address it during the report?
Let's answer now.
Applications have been received next week. This week and next week, staff from LRC will interview, and then they'll contact leadership of the legislature, who will make the final selections mid-November. Candidates will be notified and come to work when the session starts.
Thank you.
Any other questions, comments, additions? All right, seeing none, then I'll ask for a motion to approve the agenda as it has been changed.
So
Senator Tiedemann, this is second.
Second.
Seconded by Representative Carson. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion carried. Director's report, Mr. Frey, if you would please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There are two things that I want to cover in the director's report. Just a quick reference to the financial statement. It is early in the cycle, therefore the numbers are relatively meaningless at this point, but we are on budget. Everything is fine. We'll be able to pay for this for the special session yesterday, and we have money to do that, and we have money for the 35-day session. Already, those of you who are in leadership positions might remind your colleagues that a 35-day session is much compressed, and the deadlines for bill introduction come very, very quickly. So have them, you know, get them ready, and if they can get their drafting orders into us at earliest possible, we've been on, you know, we're now ready to draft. We put some of them off as we did maps and numbers, but we're now now into full scale, full bore drafting mode. So if they've got ideas, have them pump them out. It would be good to get those in the can before we start session, because again, the deadlines do come. Come pretty early. So we're in good shape on the budget, at least as far as the time is concerned. And if I might, I'm going to make sure that everybody knows our new member of the staff. Poor Amanda is going to get embarrassed here, but if Amanda Rice would stand up, please. We have a new member as a legislative attorney on our staff. She's already gotten her feet wet with a number of rules, and Ruben is now conducting drafting class for her and a couple of fiscal people. So thanks, Amanda. Amanda comes to us from Illinois, but not Chicago, more rural area of Illinois. Graduated undergraduate work at University of Nebraska-Lincoln, so she's a Big Red fan. We're trying to get her past that, but we'll see how that goes. And then also a graduate of Drake Law School. So it comes highly recommended by her her mentors when she worked as an intern in Des Moines, and also a good, very, very fine academic record. So we are very pleased to welcome her to the staff, and hope that you will find her congenial, as I'm sure you will. So, but I want to make sure that everybody knew who she was if you hadn't met her over the couple of committee meetings that she's been involved in, and also yesterday's session. And that concludes my report, Mr. Chairman. So we can move on.
All right. Any questions, Mr. Frey? You'll see on the agenda we did have approved photographer for the 2012 legislative session. That's already been taken care of, Mr. Frey. In conversations, indications are that it was a two-year contract. Is that correct?
That's right.
And so the same individual will be back again this year. All right. I'm anticipating Mr. Dilges to be here at any time. So why don't we go ahead and start with reports of the intern committees, and maybe we can get one or two in before he arrives. The first one is the Ag Land Assessment Task Force.
Senator Hunoff, that was actually Senator Hunoff on the phone when you were in there. She's feeling poorly, but she will.
Good morning. I'm Fred Botts. I'm the staff person who staffs the Ag Land Assessment Task Force. The Ag Land Assessment Task Force is something that's created by statute. Its membership includes four members of the House, two Republicans and two Democrats, and four members of the Senate. And then there's six members from the public. Two of them have to have a business background, and two have to have an ag background, and they're appointed by the leaderships in the House and the Senate. We had three meetings this year. It's really well attended by the department. South Dakota State University Economics Department is involved in it. We probably have 10 to 15 directors of equalization present at the meeting, as well as a number listening by conference phone. Many of the ag groups attend and are involved in the committee, and then we had a number of individual farmers who were very interested in the workings of the task force. The task force assignments to work on assessment and taxation of agricultural land as we moved from the market system to the productivity value system. A couple of things that they're charged with is one, on looking at the proper percentage for the annual earning capacity, or sometimes referred to as the landlord share, which currently for crop is 35% and 100% of the non-crop rent. They're also charged with looking at the capitalization rate, or what you might refer to as a multiplier, which is set by statute at 6.6%. The productivity model uses a 8-year Olympic averages of yields and commodity prices on a cropland side, and uses an 8-year Olympic average of cash rents on a non-crop side. Once that productivity formula is produced, the average crop and non-crop values are given to the directors of equalization by the Department of Revenue. The directors of equalization then apply that to the soil surveys, and we have soil surveys completed across the state. Land is rated from 1 to 0.01 and divided into 8 different classes of land. Probably one of the biggest issues that we heard the most about this year is kind of the modifiers or the adjustment factors that the directors of equalization apply to the land, you know, for like rocks, topography, slope, size of the land. Some of the directors, I think, are doing a much better job than others. Some have somewhat abandoned that system because they weren't sure why the modifiers they used to have under the market system were there. And so they removed a number of them, and so now they're kind of working to put them back in and trying to have appropriate documentation to justify the adjustments that they make. Representative Cronin kind of took a little bit of a charge on that particular issue and has worked with the department and the directors of equalization to kind of put together a document giving some direction and more information to try to have these modifiers or adjustment factors applied uniformly across the state. The task force also expressed concern about there's a 10% limitation on how much ag land values can increase or decrease each year, because under the market system we had a fairly large disparity between counties. Some counties were further ahead, some counties were way behind, and so to kind of decrease the tax income impacts on the individual farmers as well as the entities that tax, there was a 10% limitation. One of the reasons why that has become an issue is because of what's happened on the cropland side with yields and prices. As many of you know, the market price for ag land commodities is up a lot higher than when the model was first developed. Last year, the model showed that cropland values across the state should have increased 17.5% on the average. It was almost 29% in Brule County. And so that 10% limitation caused some of those counties to fall further behind if they were behind before. In fact, only one county was actually within a realm of 10%. All the other counties need to increase their cropland values by 10% or more. On the non-crop side, we have much better balance. With the rent data, that we should have about a 2% increase, and we have many counties that are within their 10% value. But we do have some that are still actually lowering their non-crop values, and other counties are increasing it. And after analysis by, or at least was a report from SDSU, at this point they didn't make any recommendations to change that landlord share that I referred to earlier or the capitalization rate. Some of the issues that the committee identified as what they're going to really evaluate further next year is switching from actual use in dealing with ag land from highest and best use. That is an issue that they're going to look at. They also have a concern about easements. We have, especially in the north central part of the state, we have a lot of wetland easements that maybe was formerly cropland, and easements have been entered into that limit that land to non-crop use. They're also going to look at cash rent information dealing with non-crop as well as the crop area. And they have a concern about the disparity between cropland and non-crop land assessments in relation to their full productivity value in some counties. And they're going to continue to monitor that and actually have some legislation that addresses that issue. The other thing that they're concerned about is the communications between the directors of equalization and the Department of Revenue, and they're going to continue to work on that to try to help and aid that process to make sure that those lines of communication continue to be open and that the directors of equalization feel empowered to do their jobs. One of the things that I also reported to the committee was dealing with, we kind of looked at ag land assessment practices in the surrounding states. So I spent some time collecting information on that, and just kind of for your information, Minnesota and Nebraska use the market system. Nebraska is looking at switching to a productivity model. Minnesota currently uses a lot of provisions just to try to remove the assess or the increase in values due to being next to urban areas, and all the other surrounding states use a productivity model. The task force looked at three or four different pieces of legislation, and they settled on one, which is an act to revise the limitation on increases and decreases that may be made to the total tax of value of cropland and non-cropland. What basically they're doing is amending that 10% cap limit, and they're putting in a graduated system. So if you're further away from your full productivity value, your cropland values may and non-cropland values may increase 25% in 1 year. So in 2 years, your assessments might go up 50%. And so, but that is kind of one of the issues that they're looking at and concerned with, is trying to get fairness between the counties, because some counties are much closer to the market value or to their productivity value than others, and they're trying to modify that disparity and get everybody a lot closer together. That concludes my report, and if I can, I'll answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Botts. Are there any questions or comments from the committee? Senator Cutler.
Thank you. Do we know, is there a number you can put on if the increase was capped at 10%, but had it been allowed to go up to the 17% statewide, I think you said that was the average.
For cropland.
For cropland, what the difference in terms of dollars would be in tax revenue?
Well, because of tax limitations for counties and all the other local governments, they would have no windfall taxes. You would just have a shift of taxes from one category to another. And a school general fund levy, ag is disconnected from the other groups, so you would not have an increase in a general fund. But, and then we also have limitations on capital outlay special education during this transition time, where there's really not a windfall to the schools during this transition period. So there might not be so much increase in tax revenue as there would be tax shifts between maybe cropland and non-cropland areas and between urban and rural areas. And I don't think we had anything that really did a complete analysis of those numbers.
Further questions? Yes.
So there isn't any number that you talked about in those discussions in terms of what the numbers would mean, either
not
to the
so much
taxpayers
on the,
or?
Not so much on the tax side, as more as the trying, I think they're more concerned about getting more equilibrium in the system between and minimize the disparity between different taxpayers that may have similar production value land but are being taxed differently now depending on which county they are in, or whether they have cropland or non-cropland.
One more question, Mr. Chair, if I may.
Go ahead.
In looking at the other states that use productivity, do we have any information about how they've handled some of these types of disparities?
Well, Iowa has severe problems right now because they have a 4% limitation on increases in values for ag land and owner-occupied properties. And when I talk to the Department of Revenue there, they feel that their ag land's being assessed at 30% of its market value. And there was another non-ag group that said that they're probably closer to 20. So they are having severe problems from kind of the limitations they have. It's, to me, similar that we had when we had the 150% rule. They're putting limitations on themselves that are disallowing these changes. But I think nobody foresaw this change in the market in the last 3 years. If you would have asked 5 years ago if we'd have these sorts of corn prices and soybean prices, you could have made a fortune.
Go ahead. Any further questions, comments? Representative Lucas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, Fred, there's one bill that will be introduced in from this summer study.
That's correct.
Do we have a date when that would be posted on the Internet for everybody to...
The rules, I think, allow just 30 days before session, so it'll be kind of mid to late December before that's out. I do have copies of it, if you would like. I can
No, that's fine. I'll wait for the Internet.
Further questions or comments? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Botts. I'm sure we'll see you again today. Mr. Dilges, good morning, sir, if you would, please. Representative Carson, is there an introduction to this next presentation?
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
There was some concerns about in our government operations and audit report that we'd like to clear up before we present that report and the commissioner. So graciously decided he'd come and help us get that cleared up. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Dilges, we eagerly await your report.
Mr. Chairman, that kind of sounds like a trap, but nevertheless, I'll try. Good morning. My name is Jason Dilges. I'm with the Bureau of Finance and Management. Representative Carson, I had a brief discussion yesterday afternoon regarding some questions that might have arisen in the Government Operations and Audit Committee with regard to some purchases or some engine replacements, if you will, for some of the aircraft that the state operates within the Department of Transportation. So I know there was some issue with Government Operations and Audit about some expenditure corrections that took place back in the 2010 year end. So a couple years ago, that had to do with the Department of Human Services. That, I think, was discussed at a couple of prior Government Operations and Audit Committee meetings. The reason for that and kind of led up to the fact that our largest airplane that the state owns, the King Air 200, was timed out on engines, and so the result of that was that it required two new engines to be placed or to be replaced on that aircraft last fall. The cost of those engines was $840,000 plus. If you recall how internal service funds operate, they do not have the ability to pre-fund. We can't pre-fund any of those expenses through our billing rates, and so you have to upfront the costs of those upgrades and then recover those through the rates. And so without an appropriation, the fund 6012 had to incur that particular cost, and so that was the reason for some of the expenditure corrections that took place to help to do that. So I'm not sure if you have specific questions. That's the issue, I guess, at hand. If there's other things I can try and clear up, I'd sure be happy to do that.
Questions? Senator Hunstead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. While I might try to see, frankly, our audit report talks about the fact that there was a discrepancy in our audit, and we never had a chance within the committee, within GOAC, to actually look at what the audit report said and what the response was. In fact, the response was, I think, from the Department of Transportation that they disagreed with the audit report, which is exactly what I said to the IRS when they said that they had a problem with my taxes. And then we discussed it a little bit, and we found out that actually on some cases, most of them, they were correct and I was wrong. So I wanted to talk about this, and it seems to me that the ones that I see in the audit report talk about transfers that were actually not brought to the Interim Appropriations Committee at a proper time. Is that? I mean, our auditor said this isn't correct, and we needed to fix it. And so I wanted to know before we turn in the report to this committee what happened. In fact, our auditor still in the report says that the interim appropriations committee did not approve these transfers. Is that possible?
Mr. Chairman, the context in which the transaction occurred was what is referred to in government terms as an expenditure correction. It was not a transfer that was done. So what happened is expenses were transferred from the Department of Transportation to the Department of Human Services, in this instance for fuel. And so a budget transfer in that sense was not necessary because the expenses were already incurred, and so the expense was transferred out. The reason why we disagreed was that we had done many of the same similar things a year prior, had no audit exceptions or findings, and then these were done in the subsequent fiscal year. So I would disagree that a budget transfer was necessary. State government does literally thousands of expenditure corrections every single year, and so in that context, I don't believe that a transfer was necessary.
Follow.
Go ahead.
I'll just share with you that some of those expenses they hadn't caught in a previous year, even in my own income tax statement, and so I thought it was okay the following year, but they proved to me that I was wrong both years. So saying that somebody didn't happen to catch it a year before is really not a very good answer, or at least the IRS didn't think so. So I just thought I'd share that with you.
Senator Hunt said if we could stay away from the self-incrimination, it'd probably be in your best interest if we could.
I've taken care of my problems, and I understand that we can disagree. Our report that we're going to submit to the e-board today says no further, only says no further action is required, and I needed to know why we don't have to have further action. So let me see if I can get it correct in my head. We have an engine that goes bad. We don't have a fund set up to repair this, and so we had to make some transfers to make sure we had enough money to replace the engines. Is that fair?
Mr. Chairman, the engines didn't go bad. They were timed out. The FAA requires that at a certain number of hours, the engines must be replaced. Otherwise, the aircraft needs to be grounded. So it wasn't a decision of should we. It was we had to, or we would basically lose the ability to use that aircraft. Second of all, yes, at the end of two fiscal years, there were some expenditure corrections that were done to use general funds to be able to make this type of upgrade without coming in and having to ask for $840,000 of general funds. And so as a past pattern of practice, the state had done numerous expenditure corrections to facilitate things like that. Like I said, things were done. Whether it was caught or not, again, that's very widely recognized as an appropriate mechanism within state government. I'm talking the expenditure corrections. And again, thousands of them are literally done every year. They're reviewed by legislative audit. There was nothing sneaky or hidden in this. It was done all above board. There was a disagreement between the Department of Legislative Audit on the Human Services expenditure correction and the executive branch. We did not agree with that, and so we voiced our disagreement on that issue. The end result is we were able to pay for the engines without a new appropriation, and so I guess, again, this may be an instance where we agree to disagree.
Fine.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It seems if an engine is going to time out, that we might foresee this happening if we looked at the hour report and so forth, and could, in fact, budget for such a thing. I mean, if the engine cranked I don't understand jet engines. So if something went wrong with it, you might not foresee it. But if it was a timed out sort of a situation, you would have thought it would have been in the budget or could have been in the budget anyway. I'll let you respond to that, and then I'll be done. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, yes, normally those things are budgeted for and we can see out in the future. However, in these particular instances, there were some unforeseen expenses that the state had to incur. If you remember, we had a King Air 90 that required the replacement of engines. We bought that aircraft when the engines were almost timed out. That was just an overhaul of the engines, but that cost a significant amount of money. There were some FAA requirements in terms of separation instrumentation that had to be done on some of the aircraft. You remember Governor Rounds on the way to Washington, D.C. one time had the windshield explode and had to land, and that was some additional cost that we had to incur. So if you would look at 6012, which the Appropriations Committee and the Government Operations and Audit Committee does very often, you'll see that that fund was teetering into the red because of prior expenditures. And so it's not a matter that we hadn't planned for or hadn't budgeted for that, but the cash situation in the fund just wasn't sufficient enough.
Are there any further questions or comments? Representative Abdallah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Secretary, just a quick question. Do you know how long the state has owned that particular plane?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I believe after the crash in 1993, the state procured that aircraft.
Further questions or comments? Thank you, Mr. Dill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Very much. Proceeding along with the rest of the agenda. Appropriations.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Tiedemann.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I drew the short straw. It was either the vice chair from the House or the vice chair from the Senate. And do you mind if I give the report from here?
No, I do not. Please.
Thank
please
you very
proceed.
Much. And then we also have our staff person here to add anything if I forget. So thank you. The Joint Appropriations Committee or Special Committee has met three times since session, March 28th, June 23rd, and October 14th. The March 28th meeting was primarily focused on the letters of intent that go out to the agencies. Again, they do not carry the same strength or value as a statute or bill, but they do give direction to the agencies and committees as to what we'd like to see done over the course of the year with their budgetary monies. Department of Human Services, Department of Social Services, and the Office of the Governor was given a letter of intent to focus on the South Dakota Medicaid system, that we want to make sure that the system provides better and more appropriate care for the patients and residents of South Dakota. Our understanding that this is being addressed by the Governor's Medicaid Long-Term Solutions Work Group, which has involvement of both legislators and the healthcare facilities across the state. Quarterly reports are coming in to the Joint Committee. Department of Human Services, Department of Social Service, and the UJS directing the departments to minister their FY12 appropriations and carryover funds, and that they be in conformity with the FY12 provider rate reduction proposal that was put forth using one-time money, and that was reflected in the general bill. Again, quarterly reports are expected to come in. Department of Tourism, we repassed the bill on the tax increase to 1.5%, and that this directed them as to how those dollars are to be split out, and if enough dollars do not come in to meet all of the requirements, that it's done on a pro rata basis for the archaeological research grants, the Cultural Heritage Center, and also the Tourism Challenge Grants on the Office of Arts. We also received a summary of the FY12 budget report from our staff and then went into the general bill summary. At the June 23rd meeting, we had a number of agencies brought forth to share with us. This was in our total plan to look at how they were meeting the reductions, the 10% reductions that were implemented across the board. We approved, or approved the Board of Regents' transfer of some FY12 funds as requested. Also heard a report on the Medicaid Long-Term Solutions Work Group. And we also heard the status of how the FY11 budget was playing out and how we were going to end up the year. Looked at the year-to-date general fund performance. Medicaid enrollees, the number, were budgeted for this coming year for $119,000 per month, and we've been tracking right at about $115,000 to $116,000 per month. We've had some ups and downs, but pretty much tracking along that line. We also had two additional letters of intent that were sent out at that time to the Board of Regents, one on a performance improvement fund. We passed the bill to give them the additional $1.5 million to be used, and they were to report back how that was going to be given out, looking at Center for Statewide E-Learning at Aberdeen, that was going to be refunded, research infrastructure, and student success. The Board of Regents were also asked to monitor the contract and grants over the next year. This really will give us some baseline data as we move forward. We've also asked for the past 5 years of contracts and grants to see what impact the reduction in their, that 10% reduction will have on their contracts and grant awards that come in to South Dakota universities. We also have to take into account that the pork coming from Washington, D.C. has also decreased, and that the federal dollars have decreased for federal grants. So there will be some other things that will play into this that can't be directly attributed to the 10% decrease. Because of financial constraints, the Joint Committee decided to forgo an east-west river tour for this year. Typically, the committee has gone out and visited where the money has been spent over the last couple years, i.e. buildings, changes in situations across the state. At the October 14th meeting, again, we received information on year-to-date general fund and trust fund performance to give us an idea where our revenue was going or coming in, and also looking at some of the expenditures. We discussed requesting the condition statements on other funds from BFM for the coming session. The co-chairs are going to meet with the staff and also BFM to identify, so we're not calling on all of the other funds' condition statements, but we want to try to avoid a situation where a legislator brings forth a bill, is told that there's this amount of dollars there, and finds out later that it's been obligated. We would encourage communication to the chairs of the committee so that this doesn't occur in future sessions, so that we know that this is one we'll find out what the true condition statement is. We also discussed the FY12 budget implementation regarding the school districts. A survey was developed by Co-Chair Brown and sent out by staff. Annie Milhoff put that together. I think there was like 104 out of the 153 that responded. It gave us some excellent data point in time. I think there's going to be more value looking at that over trends. There were some concerns that were raised as we looked at it. One, the districts were using capital outlay for ongoing expenses as we authorized them to do it, and they were also using their reserves to help make it through the current year. But we're also looking at then what are the projected enrollments for the coming year. I think it will give us some good data as we move forward in the coming session, but even more so in future sessions. We also heard from the Department of Game, Fish, and Parks on their report talking about the amount of flood damage that they had in the park systems, especially along the Missouri River and over in northeast and eastern South Dakota. Department of Corrections, Department of Social Service, Office of School Public Lands, Office of the Treasurer also discussed with us how they were meeting the demands of the 10% cut in budget to alert us to any potential problems. We then heard reports from Medicaid Long-Term Solutions Work Group, the Health Insurance Exchange, infant mortality, and also the higher education task forces that were put in place. Our next meeting will be December 6th after the governor's budget, and that's where we'll look at and see what the agencies have requested for the coming year and start developing the hearing schedule for the session and give directions to staff on what information we would like. And I would stand by for any questions.
All right, thank you. Any questions or comments from the committee? Representative Lucas.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. Representative or Senator, in regard to the school district survey that Senator Brown came up with, I know that there were some schools that were criticized, at least on the blogs, for not submitting their surveys. And I don't know what the reasons were. They responded, some of them, that they don't trust state government anymore because we didn't fund them according to what the law was as we changed the funding per student allocation. I guess my point is we get these end-of-the-year reports June 30th. Isn't that adequate enough to gather data from those reports that are sent in on unencumbered funds, how they spent the funds, that throwing out this other survey, is it really necessary to do that?
Mr. Chair, well, thank you for the question. And I think that the committee really took the approach that we applauded the school districts that did provide the information to us. Now, if the blogs, we have no control over blogs. I don't read them personally. But I think that the positive thing is that it demonstrated that they're willing to work with us to find solutions for the future and identified some areas that are of a concern to the total committee. We worked with the Secretary of Education in also putting out the survey. I visited personally with the superintendent from Brookings, and we talked. It took him about 10 minutes to put the survey together and answer, and because the information was there. We found it to be very beneficial as a starting point. Thank you.
Further questions or comments? Seeing none.
Thank you, Senator. Appreciate
that. Okay, next. On the agenda is bonding, and we will be taking that at our December 6th meeting. Next, Code Commission. Good morning.
Good morning, Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Doug Decker. I'm the Code Counsel for the State of South Dakota and staff person for the Code Commission. As the report indicates, the Code Commission has the statutory authority to supervise the publication of the code. And as an exercise of that authority, the Commission met in June of this year and reviewed the size of each volume and the size of the pocket parts for each volume and determined that in conjunction with West Publishing, who we contract with to publish the code, that two volumes were necessary to reprint. And that was volumes 19 and 20. And in the context of that discussion, it was decided to combine a portion of each of those volumes so that when we reprinted the code, we'd end up with three volumes of code, 19, 19A, and 20. The reason for that is that in reconfiguring the titles amongst those two volumes, we would only need to reprint three volumes as opposed to four volumes if we did one reprint this year, split it, and one reprint next year and split it based on the size of each one. So that was one of the things that the commission did this year. The second thing is the publishing contract, when it was originally awarded, was for a five-year term. Then at the end of that five-year term, it's renewed annually. The contract was renewed again this year with West Publishing. I have a good working relationship with the editors. They're very accommodating. We also had a state bar committee that worked with the editors in improving the index, and that was well received by the state bar and West Publishing. So I would recommend that we continue the contract with West Publishing. And finally, the commission had new membership due to turnover in the legislature. Senator Cutler is now a member of the commission and is the vice chair. The other new member is Representative Gosch. And one former legislator Maggie Gillespie was appointed by the state bar to replace Lee McCarron. So that's the new membership. The members that held over, one is an e-board appointment. That's former legislator Mike DeMersman, and the state bar appointment of Tom Lee. He is a lawyer here in Pierre. And that would conclude my report.
Thank you, Mr. Decker. Questions or comments? Thank you very much. Executive Board. Senator Cutler. No, I'm sorry. Thank you. Well, the Executive Board this year, and I'm going to be really brief because I'm briefing the Executive Board. Just kind of some of the highlights of some of the things we did. You know, there have been questions since the new group of freshman legislators have come in as to whether or not they can travel outside the state for various committee meetings and conventions and what have you. I think the Executive Board did a fair job of determining that we also are going to cut back during these times of reduced revenues, and consequently it was determined by the board that we would fund all of the interim studies, the summer studies, and those meetings that took place in state, and of course we did have to spend some additional funds because of the redistricting. But I think listening to what participating in the final redistricting plan yesterday, the seven meetings and thousands of hours were worth it, because I think we came up with an excellent plan. In addition to that, we determined that if you were a chair or vice chair of a committee, of a national committee, you would in fact be allowed to travel. We took on some additional expenses that the board approved, but still, to the to the credit of the Executive Board and the Mr. Fry and his staff, we were able to revert some funds back to the state. And so, you know, I think overall we've had an excellent year. There have been a number of issues which I want to thank all of you for handling very, very professionally and to the benefit of the people of the state of South Dakota. And so, with that, I will conclude my presentation. If you have any questions or comments, we'd be certainly anxious to hear them at this time. Senator Cutler, you have something to say now?
I do, Mr. Chairman. Just by way of information to you, I know many of you know that I've been involved with CSG and NCSL over the years. I recently received the appointment as chair of the Law and Justice Committee for NCSL, and I remain, my appointment was renewed for CSG to represent them on NCSL's executive committee. So that's about a 10-state region that we represent on NCSL's executive committee by way of appointment through CSG. I know several other members of the body are involved and have traveled at many times at their own expense, but we are able to continue our presence there, and I'm appreciative for the support that I've received. Some of you know I ran for vice president of NCSL this past August, and while I was not successful, it did come down to South Dakota and Oregon, and the chair told me that the decision by the selection committee was basically that presently the incoming president, who is president now, is from Kansas, and so part of the decision was to send it out to a western state instead of giving the presidency to another Midwestern state. But I haven't given up my attempt. If I'm still around 2 years from now, I do plan to run again. So many of you were very supportive, and I want to thank you for that, including both the majority and minority officers of both chambers wrote letters of support for me. And I want to publicly thank them on the record. That was very helpful to me in the run, in the bid for that, that I had the support of both the majority and minority party officers. So thank you to everyone who gave me a lot of encouragement and support. And thank you to the executive committee here for allowing me to continue to go, and at least I receive some reimbursement now as chair of Law and Justice.
Thank you, Senator.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Hunstead.
Well, I want to say thank you for what you do. With term limits in South Dakota, we don't stick around as long as other states, and the influence that we have amongst our fellows across the country depend on a few of us aspiring to take on those leadership roles, and it's difficult for us to do this, and so we're happy that you made the attempt and keep us somewhere in the game. Thank you.
Representative Feinstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and also like to commend my colleague from District 14, former law school classmate, and a fellow member of the class of 95. But I also want to also say how much emphasis and how important some of these travel situations are. And I hope we're able to rethink how we budget our travel budget, considering that we are one of the second of three branches of government in the state. We meet 40 days a year. We need to learn how to become a stronger body and a stronger force. And I think we don't want to lose sight of what's really important. And a lot of folks that haven't traveled don't understand the importance of some of these events like CSG and NCSL. And I hope we can revisit that, hope our funding situations are better, and we can make it a point where maybe more of us are part of the leadership of these groups. Thank you.
Senator Cadillac, please.
By way of follow-up to those remarks, and thank you for those, I also think it's really important, especially for the new members who are coming in who have never really had a chance to go out and be involved at that level, that South Dakota's had a good presence. We're often relied on because they know the people who come out there generally will actually go to all the meetings and work hard. And it gives you different opportunities and leadership at a different level. I know that in this past year, I was able to go out to Congress and appear before them and testify on behalf of NCSL and the states about unfunded mandates coming from Congress, about the rules that they write in their agencies and how those rules affect our state budgets at a time that budgets are in such crisis and remain that way across the nation. And so these are really important things. And, you know, none of us, as you said, are because of term limits, we won't be here to carry that on. And I am concerned that the new members and the people coming up have some of those same opportunities to continue to take a state like South Dakota and keep our presence and keep our voice heard at the national level.
Further questions or comments? Seeing none? All right, thank you. Moving on, government operations and audit.
Mr. Chairman, this morning we have our staff person, Tim Flannery, who will be giving the report, if that's okay.
Yes, of course.
Thank you.
I'm going to have to skip over, probably have to skip over her because she gets it after 10.
Okay.
So, let's see how long Tim takes.
Good morning, Mr. Flannery.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the board. The report prepared for you is comprised of two elements. The first is the responsibilities of the Government Operations and Audit Committee, and the second is the activities of the committee during calendar year 2011. The 10-member statutorily created Government Operations and Audit Committee's responsibilities include inquiry and review of any phase of the operations and fiscal affairs of any department, institution, board, or agency of the state, and the review of operations of the state's correctional system, including review of abuse or neglect in juvenile corrections facilities. During the year, the committee was active in reviewing juvenile corrections issues. The committee reviewed the semiannual juvenile corrections monitor reports prepared by the Department of Human Services on substantiated and unsubstantiated cases of abuse and neglect involving juveniles in the custody and care of the Department of Corrections. The committee also received and reviewed the semiannual report on abuse and alleged abuse and neglect of juveniles in private contracted facilities, which is prepared by the Department of Corrections. The committee reviewed the State of South Dakota single audit report, which includes the complete set of financial statements of the State of South Dakota and the schedule of findings and question costs for various state agencies. This schedule of findings included 35 recommendations relating to inadequate internal control procedures over receipts, revenue collections, expenditures, and financial reporting, 5 recommendations relating to violations of federal laws and regulations, and 5 recommendations related to state compliance issues. The committee requested that 4 agencies appear and respond to various audit findings. Corrective action included agreements by agencies to improve internal controls over administering various aspects of external financial reporting, agreements to develop better accounting policies, segregating duties amongst employees, develop physical inventory control procedures, agreement to deposit certain revenue in a more timely manner, agreement to provide additional employee training, to take steps to ensure more timely performance of subrecipient monitoring reviews and agreements to improve controls over monitoring food inventories in the food distribution program. Various other activities of committee during the year are as follows. The committee heard testimony from the Office of the State Engineer regarding their role in managing building construction projects in the state, and they explored specifically the bidding process, contract terms and conditions, contract retainage, progress payments, construction change orders, punch list items, final payments, and a South Dakota codified law relating to that topic. The commissioner of the Bureau of Administration reported to the committee on how major repair maintenance projects are developed and budgeted for. He provided the committee a report of statewide projects as well as projects on the Capitol complex. The commissioner also explained to the committee how bad debts of the state are tracked and collected. The committee heard testimony from the Department of Revenue and the state treasurer on the reasons for a recent reporting error that occurred in the monthly statistical report that is provided to the Bureau of Finance and Management and the Legislative Research Council. This report is relied upon for budgetary purposes. The Secretary of the Department of Transportation addressed the committee on how highway construction projects are developed. He went into considerable detail on the availability of funding, accident data, studies collected, the volume of traffic and public input that must be considered before a project is selected. An additional DOT topic that the Secretary addressed was noxious weed spraying contracts along DOT right-of-ways. The Department of Labor and Regulation was asked to appear before the committee to review their procedures for handling mediation of contract disputes involving public employees. The committee invited the 4 technical institutions in to report on how the 2012 budget reductions had affected their respective institutions. An ongoing activity of the committee is the review of various state government other funds. The cash basis activity of all the state's other funds are annually reported by our office in what is called the Blue Book. Over the past year, the committee selected 8 different state agencies to come in and review their other fund activity. This last June, the committee invited the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers in to discuss the Missouri River flooding event. They met by a conference call with Ms. Jody Farhat, the chief of the Missouri River Basin Water Management Division. Ms. Farhat explained the circumstances that led up to the need for record high releases from the 6 dams on the system and answered committee questions. And lastly, numerous miscellaneous areas of concern were raised by current events or individual committee members and were looked into. That is the end of my prepared remarks, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. I guess I didn't realize our chair had stepped out. There he is. Thank you. Are there questions of the committee?
Madam Chairman.
Senator Hunstad.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. And I think we need to go back at least briefly to the fact that Jason Dilges was here talking to us about one of these. So the reason that I asked the question is, as you could hear, there's lots of stuff we've done. We've asked a lot of critical questions of folks within state government. It is the job of audit and operation to do this. And on the top of page 3, it says, on almost every one of these reports, someone has come back to us and said, here's what we're going to do to see that this doesn't happen again, or here's a corrective action, we're going to deposit more frequently. And on this particular report, and the reason that we had Jason here, there was nothing that happened like that. We just said no further, nothing further was deemed necessary, even though there was no corrective action. There is within our processes in the legislature, we just talked a minute ago about being strong and our ability to be part of this government. We have processes within our state government to control transfers within state government, and it goes through not just audit and operation, but it goes through our interim appropriations. We realize that we can't anticipate everything that's going to happen budgetarily and that things can happen. We have a procedure. The procedure says if you're going to make transfers, that those transfers need to be approved by the interim appropriations. And it seems to me if we don't have some corrective action in this, either our auditor was wrong and should have never brought it up, or they were wrong because they didn't follow procedures. And it seems to me that at the very least, if we don't ask the Department of Transportation, or in this case, Mr. Dilges, because it was about a transfer and he was probably more in line with that than the Department of Transportation, if we don't ask for corrective action here, it seems to me we set a bad precedent that says, yeah, it's okay as long as you can come to us after the fact and say, well, hey, the engine had to be changed and we did what it took. I think I just want to say that about this report, because I think that report in the top paragraph of page 3, I believe we should have done more in government operations and audit. I asked about it during the committee. I thought we were going to get more information, and today, of course, we did. So thank you, committee.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments? Senator Tiedemann.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it needs to be put on record that the Appropriations Committee doesn't approve. We do not approve the transfers. We are made aware of the transfers. The Bureau of Finance and Management Commissioner has the authority to make those transfers. And something that has happened in the last couple years is that we receive them electronically now, so when that transfer moves forward, we receive it immediately, where in the past we received it in paper copy, and usually it was at the end of the year almost. So there have been some changes that have been made. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Further questions or comments? Seeing none, Mr. Flanagan, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay,
Doug's here for rules and order. Pardon me? Doug's here for rules. Where she's at.
Okay. All right. As you go down the agenda, the legislative procedure has not met, and so we will not be going through that legislative redistricting unless there's something someone has a burning desire to start that over again from yesterday. I prefer not. Thank you. No, Representative Feinstein. Retirement laws has not met yet, and so we are now at rules review. Mr. Decker, if you would, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Doug Decker, Code Counsel for the State of South Dakota. I staff the Rules Review Committee. The Rules Review Committee is a statutory committee that is charged with the authority to look at the agency rules that are promulgated by each of the executive branch agencies during the interim. As you can see, the committee has met approximately 8 times during the interim. We'll meet 2 more times before the session starts, and in the course of those meetings has reviewed over 80 sets of administrative rules. When the committee looks at the rules that are proposed by an agency, we look for 2 things. Is there a clear expression of legislative intent that this agency promulgate a rule, and is that rule within that clearly expressed legislative intent? And then from that basis, the committee looks at the rule and evaluates the process. Like I said, the committee has reviewed over 27 executive branch agency licensing board or regulatory commissions for their rules that they have proposed. The 2 new programs were implemented this year. The Board of Pharmacy adopted the Prescription Drug Monitoring Program. You will recall that was a bill from a couple years ago, and they finally have that program up and running. The second was the Department of Labor and Regulation, and their appraisal board has established administrative oversight of appraisal management companies. That was a result of the lending practices that caused so much turmoil. The Department of Education proposed statewide teacher evaluation program, and that rule was suspended for a while or held back, not approved, until the agency submitted more complete information to the Rules Review Committee, and ultimately that those rules were approved. The committee will not have any legislation this year, and I'll stand by for any questions.
Thank you. Any questions or comments from the committee? Board? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Decker. Sales tax review. Mr. Botts.
Good morning. Fred Botts again. I staff the Sales Tax and Use Tax Exemption Committee this summer, and a number of the members that serve on this executive board were also on that committee. Basically, the assignment given to them was to review all the sales and use tax exemptions and to move forward legislation on any of those that the committee determined to repeal. We received a lot of information from the Department of Revenue. They were our primary presenter. Secretary Andy Gerlach made a presentation. David Wiest gave an overview of the sales and use tax history, revenues, and those sorts of items. Jan Talley, who is the director of the Business Tax Division, was involved and one of the primary presenters of the review of the sales tax exemptions. Then Jane Page, who's the deputy director, also talked about sales and use tax exemptions, as well as the streamlined sales tax project. Sales and use tax revenues for this state are approximately about $700 million, somewhere probably between 15% and 20% of the state general or the state budget. It's a very large, significant source, our primary source of revenue for the state. Property taxes would generate more money, but that goes to local government. So this is an important revenue source, and as it fluctuates, so does your capacity to fund various programs. Sales tax occurs on the point of taxation where the receipt of purchase occurs or where the service is received. South Dakota is one of the few states that has a very broad sales tax base. We also tax a number of services that would probably not be taxed in many states. So that is an issue that probably somewhat unique to us and about four or five other states. We did have a fairly good conversation about the streamlined sales tax project because that could have an impact to us if Congress would ever concur and provide legislation to allow us to tax internet sales or sales from companies that don't have nexus with this state. South Dakota is projected to lose about $40 million in fiscal year 2012 due to our inability to collect taxes on goods through the internet or probably through certain catalogs. And currently there are 21 states as of June 2011 that have implemented the provisions required by the streamlined sales tax, and there's three associate member states that are pretty close to meeting all the requirements. So about half of the states are involved in that process. What we did at the first meeting, the Department of Revenue, after they kind of gave us a history of where what we have done on the sales and use tax area, is they went and outlined each sales and use tax exemption that you find in chapters 1045 and 1046. And after the review of the department kind of explained what the exemption was, a projection on what they thought the revenue might be if the exemption was repealed, the committee was kind of surveyed to see whether they want to take that particular exemption up for further review at the next meeting. So they went through each and every one of those exemptions, and at the end we ended up with about 16 exemptions that they wanted to take up for further review at the second meeting. So at the second committee meeting, basically the department again outlined that exemption, provided probably a little bit more detail on their ability to administer that tax if the exemption was repealed, and provide some different insight or input on that. And then the committee took public testimony on the exemption. The public testimony primarily focused on people who were against the repeal. They represented either a company or a group of companies that saying they didn't want to administer their tax. It was difficult to administer or was going to impact their revenues. There was a whole host of different reasons why the committee was basically lobbied not to consider this exemption for further repeal. But anyway, as they walked through each and one of these exemptions, took public testimony, and then at the end they took a vote on each of the 16 exemptions that were put forward to the committee, and it was a roll call vote as to which exemptions they wanted to submit as legislation at this next session. Basically, the committee at the end of its work came up with just two exemptions that they wish to repeal, and there's two bills dealing with or one exemption that they wish to repeal, which is the coins, currency, and bullion, which was passed in 2007. You passed an exemption to exempt those types of purchases from tax. And then the other one was actually an increase in a current tax. The tax on boats goes to the general fund. It doesn't go to the highway fund or other areas. It'd be similar to the tax probably that we levy on farm machinery. Currently, it's levied at the rate of 3%, and the committee proposed to increase that to 4%. That would generate about $300,000. They did take public testimony on issues dealing with attorney and accountant reimbursable expenses. We talked about farm machinery parts and repairs and services. A lot of our implement dealers are on the borders of the state. None of our surrounding states tax a lot of those types of products. We talked about commercial fertilizer. We had a fairly long discussion about advertising, and there's only a couple states in the nation that actually tax advertising. It's rather difficult, and they received lots of different testimony on whether it's actually an applicable tax and some of the concerns that were expressed as to whether who would actually pay the tax, and would it be somewhat of a tax shift to the consumer or to whatever? We ended up with, like I said, three bills, one dealing with coins and currency. One was to increase the tax on the excise tax on boats, and then there was a cleanup bill where we cleaned up about 8 to 10 sections of outdated provisions or sections that of language that are no longer applicable. Basically, that concludes my report, and I'll try to answer any questions. The one thing I'd like to add, if you're interested in looking at the list of sales and use tax exemptions that the committee looked at, they are out there on the internet under the interim and under committee documents for the sales and use tax committee. You'll find a table that lists all the exemptions and the estimates that Department of Revenue had at the first meeting, as well as some additional material that they had for the second meeting dealing with the narrowed 16. And also there is a copy of the presentation made by the Department of Revenue that gave kind of a history and overview of the sales and use tax is also out there under committee documents. So there's a lot of information available if you wish to study this matter, whether if you have a personal interest in this area.
Thank you. Well, before I ask for questions or comments, I was the chair of that committee, and Senator Tiedemann was the vice chair. To say that I went in being really, really optimistic is true. I thought with $527 million in sales tax exemptions out there that I felt certain that we could come up with a fairly substantial amount that we could take to the legislature. It would still have to go through House and Senate committees and House and Senate floors and down to the governor. But as we progressed on that, the final day, as we were going through the 16 exemptions, it became very apparent that the people of South Dakota who were in fact testifying were certainly not in favor of making any major changes to the sales tax code, and if you go through the minutes of the meeting, you'll find that there, in many cases, the vote was 3-12 or 2-13, or we did have a couple that were fairly close. So that indicated to me that my expectations were certainly wrong, and the members of the legislature were not in any position at this time to make major changes in the sales tax laws as they were. So be that as they may, we do have the The three bills, the cleanup, of course, and then the bullion, which is $32,000 therefore, and then the boats is actually an excise tax, and so that is not a sales tax exemption. My hope to come to the legislature with maybe $50-75 million in tax exemption bills is now reduced to hoping that we can pay for the summer study. So, with that in mind, I do want to say that it was a tremendous experience for me. I mean, what a learning experience, because first of all, Mr. Botts did a tremendous job, and I do have to give a lot of credibility to the Department of Revenue in working with them. There was not a single question that was asked of them that they didn't have an answer for. They are a very, very knowledgeable group, and it's unfortunate that the entire legislature was not able to sit through that process, because there's so much to be learned in that. But you know, that's just the way it is. But anyway, Fred, I want to thank you and once again to the Department of Revenue. Any other questions or comments? Representative Feinstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that report, and I've heard that from other members of the committee. I just find it quite surprising that when we look back at that interim study report and the evaluations of what we should study, that overwhelmingly, almost 2-1, that was the study we were going to go about. In other words, the legislators, 105 of us, I was looking back at it. I don't know exactly if all 105 of us said, let's do a sales tax exemption report, but it was pretty darn conclusive. And I think we all went in with that expectation. And again, I was not a member of the committee. And you come back and you're a little bit horrified that we only found $310,000 worth of savings. That will cover the price of it, I hope, unless you guys ate lobster tail every night. But it is surprising when and again, I was not privy or I wasn't there, and I don't know who all testified. But I didn't know if it was the citizens or if it was business owners or if it was lobbyists. But we do have right now already, in my understanding, the broadest sales tax base in the country or close to it. And we tax things that aren't taxed in other states, lawyer fees, accountant fees, realtor fees, things like that. And it just is a little surprising that some things we weren't able to find and say, well, we seem to be the first anyway in taxing some of this stuff. Why not go in and do it? And I mean, I commend you for doing it because obviously you listened to the testimony and came up with it. But it's just so hard to fathom that that's what we ended up with when we all thought as a legislator that there was stuff out there. And I wish we all were a part of it. Thank you. Thank you.
Further comments? Seeing none, Mr. Botts, once again, thank you very much. Next on our list is state-tribal relations.
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, the State-Tribal Relations Committee met three times this year in 2011.
Tom, would you introduce yourself, please?
Tom Agadence with LRC. And I've staffed State Tribal since, I think, 1998. The chair for this term is Representative Bruner, Vice Chair Senator Maher, and another member, Senator Teason, is also a member of the State Tribal Relations Committee. The committee was established by statute in 1993. It was part of Governor Mickelson's reconciliation program, and it's been an ongoing study committee since 1993. It differs in some ways from other interim study committees. The members are appointed to two-year terms. The committee elects its own chair and vice chair. The committee selects its own study topics and then reports to the e-board. The committee generally meets 3-4 times each year per interim, which is about the same as other types of committees. We try to meet at least once outside of peer, usually on a reservation or other appropriate facility. We probably had one less meeting this year than normal. In late August and early September, the redistricting committee met several times on several different reservations, and the logistics of that and inserting state tribal into that situation wasn't probably the best thing to do. So we moved our meeting back to mid-October and finished with that. For the three meetings, we met March 11th in Pierre, which was still during session. It was a short organizational meeting. We selected a chair and a vice chair, Representative Bruner and Senator Maher, discussed plans for the interim, also were introduced to and got a short presentation from J.R. LaPlante, who's the secretary of the new Department of Tribal Relations, which was established by Governor Dugard this last January. Our second meeting was May 26th in Pierre, and tried to use this meeting to familiarize new members of the committee, because it was a new group this time, with general issues and background stuff dealing with state-tribal relations. We had reports from a number of state agencies on activities and issues that they're involved with that affect the Native American population. We also got background information for new committee members and so on. There was a presentation from Charlie McGuigan in the Attorney General's office, a very good presentation dealing with the history of the development of reservations in South Dakota going through the treaties in the 19th century and how all of that developed, a discussion of land issues and land policy, a discussion of federal and state policy toward the tribes over history. He also talked a lot about legal jurisdiction issues and how the state and the feds and the tribes interact in those types of things. We had a longer presentation from Secretary LaPlante. He talked about the goals and activities for the new department and some of the things that he's interested in doing. He would like to do some kind of new state-tribal relationship study, a task force type of thing that's more in-depth than what the committee would do. This was last done in 1974 and 75 in South Dakota, and he is looking for ways to get that done and possibly funding and so on. We had at this meeting, there was also a short report from Roger Campbell, who is the previous head of the department or the Office of Tribal Government Relations, and he's now director of the Office of Indian Education with the Department of Education. There was a report from David Wiest from the Department of Revenue on tax collection agreements between the state, and I believe almost all of the tribes have agreements in place with the state. Kim Malsom-Risden, Department of Social Services, discussed programs in her department that affect the tribes. And there was a slot for public testimony. Our last meeting was October 13th in Eagle Butte with the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe. This is the first time that the committee has ever met at the Cheyenne River Reservation. I was happy that we were able to set that up, and I think it was turned out to be a good meeting. Secretary LaPlante again updated the committee on the activities through the summer of his new department. We had a presentation from Tribal Chairman Kevin Keckler and also other tribal officials, particularly in the area of health care, and there was also public testimony at that meeting. In the afternoon on the 13th, we toured a pretty impressive new Indian Health Service hospital that was just completed. It'll be open at the beginning of November. It was a pretty amazing facility, really. The whole thing is heated with geothermal energy, and it looked to be really something. One of the problems that all the tribes have in the medical area, attracting physicians and other medical personnel and recruiting them and keeping them on the reservation is both the facilities themselves and also housing. And so in conjunction with the new hospital there have been a number of very nice brand-new housing units that have been built, separate standalone houses and also duplex types of things. We toured those, again, very nice, and I think it should help that community a lot. We also toured the nursing home in Eagle Butte. That's a brand-new facility. It's built and ready to go. It is not yet occupied. They're expecting that it will be soon, and hopefully that'll come to fruition. At the end of that, with those tours, we also had a fairly lengthy informal discussion with the new tribal chairman and a couple of other people there, and it turned out to be a very nice discussion. I thought it was a good day. Overall, I thought that the meetings for the committee were good this year, especially as a way of introducing the new members to what the committee does and what some of the issues are. Next year, we would like to focus more on some specific issues as the members have more experience. But I guess I'd take any questions, or if Senator Maher or Senator Deason have any comments.
Thank you, Mr. Magidens. Any other questions or comments? Senator Tiedemann.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The nursing home facility, when was that one completed, the construction of that completed?
I think they said that it's been a couple of years. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman. I believe
Senator Maher.
I believe it was almost 3 years ago when it's still sitting empty. It's quite a facility to sit there. From what I gathered, from they're going to be getting their first drawdown on the interest revenue from the JTAC money, and they want to be able to take that money and then begin equipping that nursing facility and maybe get it open. But then again, that could be wishful thinking too.
Further questions, comments? Representative Lucas.
It might be a question more for Director Fry. I did listen to the committee meeting they had when Charlie McGuigan and J.R. LaPlante gave their testimonies, and I thought it was excellent information. My question is, all these reports that we're receiving today, will they be put on our website so we can peruse those at any given time? And is it possible to have like a hyperlink so if we wanted to go back not to the audio but to the written comments from those individual committee meetings, the same with the sales tax exemption as the Chair Turbevilla talked about, to go back and look at some of that testimony and votes in regard to those separate issues?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Yes. The report is currently in draft form that you have in your packet for today. Once the reports have been approved by the Executive Board, we will place those on our website so that people can also can access those reports. To the extent that we have text testimony from the participating witnesses, we'll put those in the documents section of the interim committees. You're familiar with how we do the documents there and so on, based on, you can search them by committee or by area, and we'll have, to the extent that we have those in some kind of form, actual physical form, we'll place those out there in the documents section. So you'll be able to look at all of that.
Senator Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick comment. As Tom stated, much of what we talked about on at Eagle Butte was health care. Indeed, a very impressive facility, more than $100 million a facility with the housing that's there, a beautiful facility. The issue remains, and it's perhaps borne out as well in the nursing home, is staffing of these facilities. And it's it's already a concern that with the new hospital ready to open its doors, as to whether it's going to be adequately staffed. There may be empty rooms that are awaiting a doctor or a dentist or a nurse to show up to work there. And of course that's important to the state, because as IHS comes up short on its support of health care for Native Americans, the state, that's the trickle down, comes to the state and becomes an additional an expense or burden, I think, for the state. So, and just an important issue for us to continue to monitor. Again, we were very well received at Eagle Butte, very impressed with the presentations that we had there and the people that we met. But an interesting discussion, our hour-long hallway discussion in the nursing home with the chairman and others from the tribe, centered on their abilities to have adequate health care for their members. Important consideration for them. Thank you.
Just follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Yes.
Senator Tomorrow. To piggyback on what Senator Thiessen was just talking about, a perfect example is the fact in that new hospital, there's 28 or 30 dental chairs, and they currently have one dentist on staff. And so they are trying to maybe work with some of the dental schools to bring interns in to utilize this massive, massive room of dental chairs and dental wing of this whole entire hospital. So it's going to be interesting to see how it all plays out.
Further questions or comments? Thanks. Okay, we have bypassed one of the reviews because we were waiting for 10 o'clock when we could go back up and do the Department of Human Services review. And I think that we have Senator Hunhoff on the phone at this time. Senator Hunhoff, are you with us?
Yes. Good morning, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you. Please proceed.
Thank you. And again, my apologies, and thank you for allowing me to start a little bit later this morning. The Department of Human Services, that was the agency review for sunsetting. The committee did meet three times. You, I believe, have a handout A summary of our study on the first meeting consisted primarily of an overview of the Department of Human Services. Secretary Lori Gill is new to this position, so she and her staff came. There were questions that I had posed for them to cover, quite honestly, the operations of the departments and the different divisions that they had, and to drill down into the details of the facility. At the second meeting, we went on site and we visited Redfield. The first day, we took a tour of the facility. Met some of the residents, saw some of the situations for education, living, attended their school. Then we also had some tours of their living quarters. Then we did take public testimony on site on that campus, and two individuals from the community, the mayor and the superintendent of the Redfield School District, both came and presented information and certainly spoke very positively of the working relationship they have with the school there in Redfield. On the second day, then, we traveled back to Pierre, and I had requested that four programs that were outside of state government that partner with state government, the Human Services for Services, to provide an overview, get a flavor of the type of services that are out there. And so we had South Dakota Achieve from Sioux Falls, Black Hills Workshop, Independent Living Choices, and Children's Care and Hospital. And again, they talked about services and their relationship, funding relationship with the state. After that, we had some individuals that came forth, especially that had gone through Voc Rehab and had some very wonderful success stories to share about where they had to depend upon state government to re-engage the workforce, and now that they are independent of state government and able to, in their words, provide and pay taxes to take care of others. I had also asked the committee members if they had any program with there in their community to please visit that program so, again, they could get a taste for the flavor of the services that are out there. We had our third meeting yesterday morning, and that was a summary of what we had concluded. You have attached to you that summary. There was some cleanup legislation that the department brought forth. Primarily, it was legislation that spoke to how the division existed prior to the reorganization with the executive order that the governor had done this past year to move mental health services out of that division. And so after some discussion, the committee was in agreement and consent and did pass and will introduce that legislation in the next upcoming session. Secretary Gill did note and did an extensive that as she embarks on her journey as the secretary, she's looking at developing a strategic plan with her management team under the help of a consultant to look at processes. I think that came up in discussion of our review. Again, you've got Medicaid, you've got mental health services, you have others. There's sort of cross-utilization, more departments that are accessed and utilized, how to improve the process and access for the consumer that's out there, and also looking at the developmental center. One of the things that the committee was in agreement and is bringing forth as a recommendation for your body to consider, that the executive board appoint a working group composed of no more than 15 members, including four legislators and employees of state government agencies and community support providers, to achieve the following: to reassess the mission and programmatic offerings at the developmental center, to assess the potential for realignment of programs at the developmental center in conjunction with other programs being offered in communities, assess and recommend the potential integration of other human-related service offerings by the state that could allow for some potential offerings, and then to develop a time frame and a long-range plan for cost-effective implementation of community-based services. I think the one thing that we can all agree to, and Representative Lucas, certainly he was a member of the committee and certainly want to add his input on this, is that, you know, over the course of the years when Redfield was begun, for the intent and purpose of it, it was to meet the needs of those citizens, but that population has declined significantly. So where you were serving over 1,000 people, now you have 132 consumers that are on that campus, and they continue to work on transition. You have a very large campus. You have a capital asset of buildings that are out there that are not fully utilized, and because of the aging of the plant, you're going to have to look at some improvements out there over the course of time. When you look at the staffing ratio of what you have staffed to consumers, you have a very high staff to consumer ratio. That is not meant to be negative, but it also says that there are excess resources and how can we utilize those. I am proposing this with the support of the committee for consideration of your committee so that we can start being involved in the planning process and in policy making as to where should we be going with the services that are on that campus and with that entire campus. With that, I thank you, and I'll stand by for questions.
Thank you, Senator. Any questions or comments? Yes, Representative Consett.
Mr. Chair, Senator, could you tell me how many buildings are currently being maintained on the campus there?
You know, I'm embarrassed. I cannot tell you, but they all are being maintained. There's a physical plant building. There's like a community center, classrooms. There are two governor houses there that we went through that are for some of the clients for group living. I apologize, Representative. I don't have the exact figure.
Thank you.
Representative Lucas, do you know?
Representative Lucas.
Yeah, thank you, Senator. I can't recall exact number of buildings, but there's a little over 400 acres of land right there within the facility. So it is quite spacious, and as Senator Hunoff indicated, it's a challenge to keep the physical plan up. Now, there is additionally some farmland that is being leased there, and it's my understanding as part of the land the governor is looking at selling. So that may be revenue bringing into the state on the sale of that land. There's definitely more land there within the buildings, and I'm guessing there's probably 20 buildings that is needed. But some of that land is, in my opinion, therapeutic in nature, which allows some of the individuals with behavioral needs to access the outdoors. And they do some things there, like cross-country skiing. They also have a Olympic-type swimming pool there, and I'm sure there's walks and I don't think they have any livestock or animals there anymore, although at one time they did. There's a barn there that's used now as a motor pool facility. That part of, you know, the mission of that facility is no longer used that way as it was at one time. But there are some individuals there that have challenging behaviors, and I'd be reluctant to have them go back to our community service providers for the likelihood that they could end up in the criminal system. And therefore, I think the facility is still needed. However, we certainly have some space available for other uses there, and I think that's what Senator Hunoff is suggesting with the task force. And I would certainly support that, particularly it gives the legislature oversight with, and I recommended four. I don't believe we need more than that on that, but also that the community service providers would be involved in that work group, as well as other people in state government, all the way from human services to social services and some of the staff at Developmental Center in Redfield. Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, go ahead.
Don, I mean, and to add, in addition to Representative Constance's question, we did tour one building, and it was a dorm building that is no longer being utilized or being maintained that is on that campus. That was one of the buildings they did take us to see that they have vacated it.
Representative Consett.
Mr. Chair, so what I've gathered here is that we have 132 patients and we're maintaining roughly 20 buildings. How large is the staff there?
Oh, I'm amiss. I'm sorry. I'm apologizing because I wasn't at the first meeting, and I answer that. And that's poor of me as a chairman that I can't tell you that.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lucas.
Our minutes show, and I don't know the exact number, there's 138 individuals who reside there. Some of those may have been moved back to the community service providers, and there's approximately three staff members per resident. So you can do the math, and you're probably looking 40 staff members or so are there. And looking at the minutes a little bit further here, it says there's 28 buildings on the campus. Representative, our minutes reflect there's 28 buildings there.
Three patients per staff. I just a correction when you said do the math. You said three staff per patient. I believe it's the other way around, isn't it?
One employee for every three residents.
Thank you. Okay. Yeah. It started to sound like a federal job. Senator Hunstead.
Well, Redfield is in my district, and I have visited with those folks a number of times, Representative Consett, and I know that they are more than happy, and if there's some way that you get up that way to travel through, they have some truly unique problems there, and while we have lots of providers out there that have provided really excellent service to those that need it, most of the folks that are there really need the care they're getting. I can tell you that I believe it was 2 years ago we had prisoners also housed there that worked maintaining buildings and doing some things, and through a reorganization, a lot of that was vacated, and those prisoners were moved elsewhere. And you know, I was on appropriations and don't remember why, but there are some of those facilities that are not being used for that reason. And there are some real problems. If you're interested in it, I would be more than happy to set up meetings with you. Not that you couldn't do the same. So thank you.
Further questions or comments? Yes, Senator Tiedemann.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, to answer Senator Hunstad's question, I believe it was a situation where the building that the prisoners were housed needed to be renovated, and because of some repair and just maintenance damage, and the cost was so exorbitant that it was cheaper to move them into other facilities that we had and had expanded, so that's the reason that was done. I know that it had an impact on State Fair because State Fair was using some of the minimum security prisoners from there to assist with State Fair, but I don't think we've heard any negative since then.
No. I'm sorry. I didn't want to make that as a negative. I wanted to just explain that there are resources there, but these buildings are extremely old. In fact, Representative Consett, of interest, the buildings were built by and plumbed by a then legislator who, because he was a legislator and had a contract with the state, never was able to collect from the state for all the work he did, even though he was the lowest bidder. So there's a lot of interesting history, but it does give you an idea how far back, how old these buildings are, and maintenance is probably quite an issue there as well.
Further questions or comments? All right. Senator Hunhoff, are you still there?
Yes, I am.
Okay. And so your recommendation, and I think it's a good one, would be to look at next year, are you looking at a task force, or as we get into the latter part of our agenda, we're looking at agencies remaining for review? I see one as the Human Services Center. Would you think it would be in order to do the Human Services Center and the Redfield facility at the same time?
You know, that might be. You know, I guess I'm looking just from experience in a world where we've got an aging population, and certainly if you look at those numbers and what the diagnoses are of this aging population, and you're talking dementias and Alzheimer's, and you're looking at mental health services, and you're also looking Redfield, which is not at this point in time designed for that, but you do have individuals with some kind of behaviors, it might be a nice fix. But I'm looking at the recommendation I'd have was for a separate work group, not necessarily tied, but you could. That's your peruse, and certainly what the committee believes would be the best thing to do.
Okay. Are there any recommendations from the committee at this time? Representative Lucas.
Well, Mr. Chair, this may be something we don't have to act on today, possibly, because it would be funded. Well, it probably should, because it would be funded out of the FY13 budget.
I agree.
We've already submitted that budget. But our cost would only, you know, if we follow what we've done in the past, is that we'd pay expenses for the legislators participating on this task force only.
All right. Well, Senator Hunhoff, since you are so closely associated with this, would you be willing to work with a couple of members of the executive board to come up with some recommendations on the task force as far as the number of the people that would serve on that or be asked to serve on that. And Representative Lucas is correct. We need to look at this now for this next fiscal year's funding. Would you be willing to spend some time with anyone on this board that would volunteer? Representative Lucas, would you? All right.
I certainly would appreciate that opportunity. I certainly would.
All right, so we'll ask Representative Lucas and anyone else that would like to volunteer their time on this.
Mr. Chairman, I would. I think we can find some partnerships here. Perhaps the governor would even be interested in appointing some folks to this. It's under his perusal as operating this government when we're not in place and figuring out how to make use of that facility, so perhaps we could work out, and I would be happy to do what I can to help with whatever I can.
Well, since Redfield is in your district, I think that's certainly appropriate. Is there anyone else that Representative Consett, would you like to be in that also? All right, so we have the four members appointed, and if you would go ahead and Senator Hunhoff, I'm going to put you in charge of that four-member committee, and if you could look at giving us some preliminary information or actually have your task force put together with some additional thoughts as to number of meetings and things like that, so we could look at that at our December meeting.
Okay, I will gladly do that.
All right.
Thank you.
Anything else?
Oh, thank you again.
All right. Okay. Thank you.
Bye.
Okay, going back now, the interim committees, we're down to the last one, the Wind Energy Task Force. Good morning, Ruben.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Ruben Besplitz. I am the Chief of Research for the Legislative Research Council, have been man and boy for some 40-odd years and have had an opportunity to work with several of you around me today. As background, I would say that I volunteered to be Chief Staff on the Wind Energy Task Force because I have had far more experience in dealing with these mixed lay legislator bodies than anybody else on the staff. And quite frankly, they have presented some unique opportunities as well as problems. And I think that as part of my presentation on what happened on wind energy, I think it would be useful to hit upon a couple of those points so that you can, as a group that's responsible for governing our interim activities, know that some of these situations do exist and do present some unique problems. To that extent, what I say may sound critical. It's not intended to be unduly critical, but I do think that it's inherent in the governing process of the interim that you be aware that these things certainly do not work like ordinary committees do. I can reference the abortion task force, which of course was a unique train wreck that probably will not be duplicated at any time in the future. But in addition to that, with Madam Chair of the criminal code revision, we have one which was more successful but did in fact in and of itself create some unique situations that had to be dealt with. And then the one most similar to wind energy was Representative Marshall's interim committee task force on custody issues and single parent rights, which did present a lot of very difficult things, many of which are very similar to what happened in the wind energy. The first thing that happens with many of these task forces is that you have multiple people in charge of appointing the membership rather than the traditional role that's played by the executive board, where you not only select the studies but select the membership. And in every one of these particular instances that I've served on, that has posed a problem. Senator Gray was very prompt in making his appointments to the Wind Energy Committee. Unfortunately, the other two people who had the power to make appointments to the Energy Committee were not forthcoming for some period of time with their appointees, and of course that got us off to a very late start. I was hoping that we could do much of the work on the wind energy study before we got up and running on redistricting this particular interim, but as a matter of fact, we only got the Wind Energy Committee up and running in July, just about the time that we were becoming very busy with the redistricting committee. So it was not a good fit. Could have been a good, better fit if we would have had the more traditional timeline of getting started in late May, early June, as is typical with pure legislative committees. The first meeting was a good meeting, and we had an excellent report from Commissioner Gary Hansen, former legislator, now with the Public Utilities Commission. He gave a very fair and balanced presentation that told the people on the committee what they needed to know to establish that particular background. But another thing that's inherent in these lay legislative committees is that you come into these things with members on the task force who have very differing degrees of knowledge and expertise about what you're going to be working with. So we certainly had some people on that task force who knew everything that Commissioner Hansen was talking about in intimate detail before this thing ever started. And on the other hand, we had a number of folks, including myself, who were operating off of a much lower energy and experience background, and it's of course difficult to get those levels melded and feeling comfortable with each other. And again, you legislators are a club, and you know each other well, and you're used to working with each other well. When you introduce different people into that particular mix, it takes time for them to get to know each other and to get comfortable with each other. So as staffer, I had devoted a good portion of the first meeting to introductions and self-descriptions and efforts to facilitate that melding of the members so that you could work more as a coherent group. But all of that takes a certain amount of time. I also noticed, as I did during the Mercial Committee on custody issues, that the fact that there are some folks sitting at the table who are not legislators and have certain viewpoints, while there are other people who are not legislators and have certain viewpoints sitting in the audience without a vote and without a position at the table, tends to cause a certain amount of friction. And that was very evident in this particular task force study, where you had two people who were not residents of the state of South Dakota sitting on and being paid by the state of South Dakota to be there, while you had other people with a similar position sitting in the audience who did not have the same opportunity. You had several lobbyists who were serving on the commission. You had several corporate executives who were making hundreds of thousands of dollars and still getting per diem and expenses to serve on this particular committee at a time when theoretically we were didn't have enough money to send folks to NCSL. And you had a state employee sitting on this particular commission. And although I'm not saying that any of that is wrong, I am saying that it does create a particular friction between the members of the committee and the members who are there, who feel that they have as much experience and knowledge to impart to the committee as the others and don't have the same opportunity to do so. So I think we did see a large drop-off in the enthusiasm and the willingness to participate from the audience folks by the time the second meeting came around, and even more so by the time the third meeting came around, when it became obvious that the folks from the major facility companies, Iberdrola and NextEra, were in a better position to influence the position of the committee than the others. That said, we went on to the second meeting where the major idea of the meeting was to collect information from the people who are doing the primary job of developing wind energy in the state of South Dakota. And four of the six came and made excellent presentations. The other two I never so much as heard from. They wouldn't return my calls. It was pretty obvious that they were getting out of the wind energy business in South Dakota, at least from a developmental standpoint, and it took no part in the situation whatsoever. Obviously, as far as making statutory changes in the state of South Dakota that would encourage wind energy development, the main focus was taxation. And I think that was a foregone conclusion pretty much right from the beginning, quite frankly. Although I wasn't the most knowledgeable person on the committee, I could have written the report before the third meeting was over. I was also somewhat surprised to find that there were people on the committee who felt that no legislation should be coming forth from this committee, when yet it seemed obvious to me that the typical legislative function of interim committees is to produce legislation. The legislature works best when it has a piece of legislation in front of it. That's its normal work modus operandi, just like with the judiciary, it's court cases. And quite frankly, the executive branch is best when it's working with reports and implementing plans and doing executive sort of things. But we had opinion leaders on the task force who felt that legislation was inappropriate, and even though I expressed repeatedly a contrary opinion, the decision was made to write a report and make recommendations rather than introduce legislation. Those recommendations then were formulated at the third meeting, and they're found on the third page of your report. Again, they all deal with the existence of taxes on construction of wind energy facilities in South Dakota and the fact that in some aspects we are not competitive with other states. And if you were to read the report alone, I believe that you would get a somewhat unfair opinion that the only thing that's holding South Dakota back in wind energy development is the tax situation, when quite frankly it's primarily location to market and location to facilities that drives the wind energy development bus. And although Iowa and Minnesota have far less wind energy resources than we do, they're much closer to the network, and they're much closer to Chicago, which is the user of all of this energy that we're developing out here. And so they have inherent advantages in this situation, which mere tax policy is not going to be able to adequately address. That's pretty much what I have to say about the subject. I really do think that, if I may be so bold as to suggest, the executive board in future years needs to be very concerned about legislation that comes through the legislature, which in effect takes your right to govern and decide on summer studies and takes it out of your hands and puts it in the hand of a bill, which may be a lobbyist idea or some person with a particular less broad view of public policy than you yourselves do. And if that were the case, I think some of these situations could be minimized or avoided. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Excellent. Thank you. Questions or comments? Excellent job. Thank you. Representative Abdallah. We are, all right, We'll take a 10-minute recess and be back in here at 11 o'clock, about another half hour, and we'll be done. Wow, thank you. Okay. We have now gone through all of the reports of the interim committees. Before I ask for a motion to approve the reports, are there any questions or comments or anything about any of these? Keeping in mind that retirement laws and legislative procedure and bonding will all be heard during our December meeting. Any questions or comments? Representative Lucas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up again, as a member of the Human Services Agency review, that the suggestion, which is on page 10, outlines the intent of that task force. Typically, we probably don't approve task force for next summer, but that's what we're asking. If there's going to be a problem with that, particularly after Ruben testified on the hybrid-type committees, we can always pull it out and put it in as a bill. I think the mission is clear enough that I don't have a problem with it, and I also feel that by limiting it to four legislators as our what our costs would be from the legislature, that I don't see a problem with it. Most of the other people that would be involved in this would be from other state agencies or the community service providers and would be there willing to work together and not be lobbying this, you know, not to do something or to do something, as was the case in the wind energy task force. So I just want, you know, when you approve that, that's, if we approve the summer studies, that's a part of it. Thank you.
Mr. Right. Chairman,
yes,
well, I've sat here silent enough, and I'm going to take exemption to the comment that was just made. I'm going to take exemption to Ruben's comments made earlier. We have committees made up all the time of members of the public, experts in the industry. He acknowledged some of them. We have an ag advisory land task force that has met for several years talking about taxes. Who do we have on some of those committees? We have landowners on some of those committees. We have farmers on some of those committees. You know what? We had wind people, wind experts on the wind advisory task force. Were they from some of the companies that want to do business here? Absolutely they were. Why wouldn't we put them there? Unless we had just a legislative committee. We passed a bill that had members of the public on it. Check your vote on it. I suspect that flew through without much opposition. And so we all have some, we're all implicated here. I stand by the fact that we have some committees that have lay people on them, that have members of the public, that have experts on those committees. And so just as with the wind, if we want to do one for human services, I'm okay with that too.
Okay, thank you. Any other comments? All right. Would it be the desire of the executive board that when asked for approval of the reports of the interim committees, that would also include the task force as we had discussed it? Or would you rather do that separately? Do you got any preference? Any difference?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hunstad.
With these other recommendations that we're contemplating, I would not know why we'd have to do this. We will be able to pick later on and have another e-board meeting towards the end of session when we're going to be talking about having task forces or whatever. And so I wouldn't think we'd have to make that recommendation at this point. Perhaps Representative Lucas and Representative Consett and myself can come back to you with a better report. If that is...
That's fine with me. Representative Lucas.
Thank you, Chair. Well, my thinking is we do need to involve the executive branch in this, and getting started and having this outline now will give us the opportunity to do that somewhat through the session. Then if we wait till next year, then we're in more of a reactionary mode instead of a proactive. There's opportunities to do some things with the facility, and I think that's what I approach this task force as an opportunity. We want to work with other agencies, the state government, the community people, as well as the governor's office.
Mr. Chairman. Senator Cutler.
I guess I would just recommend that we have something in writing that outlines what this is and how it's to operate. Trying to do this more or less on the fly I think leaves everybody with some questions about what the expectations and who's supposed to be involved and how many meetings and all of those kinds of details that we really need to know in order to give wholehearted approval. So if we could have some sort of outline of what is supposed to happen and who's involved, I'd personally be a lot more comfortable having a proposal. As Ruben was talking about, you know, the way you work is off of a bill draft all of the time. That's what we're used to. That would certainly assist me and I think the others. So we don't get tied up here in a lengthy discussion of what it is.
Okay, at this time I'd like, if there are no further questions or comments on the reports of the interim committees, I would ask for a motion to approve the reports as were presented today. Moved by Representative Consett. Is there a second?
Second.
Seconded by Representative Carson. Any further questions, comments? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Now, let's go back. I would feel much more comfortable if we, you know, if there's going to be a task force, and this, the executive board has discussed this, and we've already appointed four people to be on the task force, and we've asked them to come back to us at our December meeting with some additional details as to number of people on the task force, what the guidelines are, where they're going to go with this. I'd feel a little more comfortable if, in fact, that we did have a voice vote to approve the appointment of that task force. Is there a motion? Seeing none, we'll go forth as.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
I think the lack of motion is just a lack of clarity on our part about what it is we're doing here. Are we asking that we just put into the record or make a record of the four members discuss during the meeting who will then just report back to us? Will they meet? Will they go out and meet off-site? Or?
No. The only thing I'm asking for, Senator, is that we have some record of the fact that we did appoint four people to start the process. You know, are they going to go, visit the facility, stuff like? No. What I'm asking for is that if the board agrees that we just have something in the minutes that says those four people are to report back to us with recommendations as to the number of people on the task force, some indication as to what the time frame would be, what other departments are involved, something like that. Now, I'm not asking them to go out and start the process now. It's just recommendations that the executive committee can then vote on at our December meeting.
So,
is there a second? Second by Senator Cutler. Any further questions or comments? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. All right, thank you. Thank you for helping me through that. Next, appoint two legislators to the Dakota Corps Scholarship Board, appointment made by the Executive Committee of the Executive Board. In, we had, at our last meeting, I believe we had some discussion on this, on the scholarships. And when I saw this on the agenda, I went and I got additional information. There's a lot more to the Dakota Corps scholarship program than I had anticipated. And what I've done with the board's with the committee's approval, I've gone to Senator Gray and Representative Lust, and I've asked them to give me the names of three individuals, two Republicans and one Democrat from the Senate and also from the House. And then what I'm going to do would be to send them the annual report, because that gives a lot more detail than we received when we discussed it at our last meeting. And to ask those six individuals whether or not they want to serve on this committee, and if they do, then with the advice and consent of the executive committee of the executive board, we'll bring a name back to you at our next meeting. Now, if there, very quickly, if there are any questions or that you might have, I have asked Paul Truman from the Board of Regents to come here today. If you got some questions, if not. Anyone?
I don't really have a question, but I as you pointed out, and I think everybody got an email, I was on that, and we took, I got these scholarships on our behalf as legislators, and I called other legislators. I know Senator Hunhoff had distributed one in her area and so forth. So, I mean, I think it's a real way to highlight the importance of this scholarship. It's a full boat, full ride scholarship. It's a great program, but I mean, it should the folks who are going to get this job need to have an idea of what it is. So I just thought I would just share that much at least with you.
No, I agree, and it's a lot of money for a. For a college student, and the purpose of the scholarship program is to keep the brightest and the best in South Dakota, and they are and they have to be studying in some very critical areas. So my thought on this was that we probably need to make this more public, because it is an excellent program, and I think it's very well run. There are more graduates apply for this than we have the money for. So, if it becomes more public, then perhaps we will be able to generate more donations to the program. Bless you.
I'll share one more point with that.
You
serve this at your own costs, your own travel expenses, your own time and talents go into this. So it has never been, and I don't, unless you make a change, is not proposed to be a paid travel or paid meeting time, I don't expect. But the folks who are going to be appointed and asked if they want to serve ought to know how this is going to work. So thank you.
Well, and Paul, correct me if I'm wrong. The first meeting is by teleconference. Is that correct? All right, and then the second meeting is held during the legislative session. So for those members of the legislature that are appointed to this board, there will probably be no expense involved. And as far as the other members, Secretary Roberts, Tony Van Huysen, Dale Birch, and Harvey Jewett, so is that – why don't you come forward and just real quickly – yes.
All except for Dale Birch, who Tony Van Huysen has replaced. And I think the expense that Senator Hunstad referenced there, I think comes with the, if you make the choice to travel to a place and kind of be a part of the award of that scholarship to a respective student. Otherwise, I think our goal is to try to make a conference call for the one that occurs in the fall and then try to do our best to schedule it where the other board members would come to peer so that we could have the two representatives from the legislature be here and most efficient with your time. So.
All right. Yeah. Very good. Thank you. Any other questions or comments? All right. Then we will have a couple names for you at our next meeting. Continuing agency interim review, you've got a list of agencies that have been studied to date. Over to the right side, agencies remaining, Bureau of Finance Management, Department of Health, Human Services Center. Is there any of these three that the board feels that you would really like to have at this next time around? Senator Thiessen?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Am I correct? We deferred at the request of department. We deferred study this year. We deferred human services. Split that off. Help me out here.
Go ahead, Senator Tiedemann.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, the Human Services Center was pulled out of the Human Resources and put in, or the Human Services Department, and put into the Social Services. And prior to when social services was sunset reviewed, it was not part of that department. So that's the only reason why I think it's listed there.
Any recommendations? Any thoughts? Senator Cutler?
It might be a good time to look at the Human Services Center in light of what Senator Tiedemann just shared with us. Also, since it's new to the Department of Social Services, it might be a good time to know how that's working and just, I think, in terms of our oversight, seeing how that's unless there's a reason why they wouldn't be ready to do that. Maybe there's nothing to report yet, but my guess is that those kinds of transitions always have issues that arise, and it might be good for us to know what those are.
Is that a motion?
Nope. I just thought I'd throw that out there.
Any other questions or comments? Senator Representative Feinstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We did discuss this, actually, when we decided to do the review of the human services. We knew it was being pulled out. We said, you know, if there were comments made that we maybe should review it, even though it's part of social services, in light of that. So it isn't an oversight. It's out here now. We got it. We got to get it done. We can't let it escape the ten-year tenure, some way or another.
Senator Tiedemann.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move that we put Department of Health and Human Services Center as the sunset review for the coming year.
Is there a second? Second by Senator Thiessen. Are there questions, comments? Representative Abdallah.
going back here to
2003. If you want to do two, that, you know, whatever the recommendation of the executive board is. Right now, we have a motion and a second to the Human Services Center.
Well, just a follow-up.
Right. Pardon me, Health and Human Services Center.
Just a follow-up. I don't care if you do two, three, or four, but I think Bureau of Finance and Management is a very important part of state government, and with the budget restraints we've had in the last two or three years, I think we ought to find out for sure. You know, I mean, that appears to be an agency or bureau that should be looked into and studied.
Okay. Mr. Fry, can you think of any reason why not to do the two, financially or whatever?
No. We would have sufficient funding, depending, again, on how many interim committees you choose next April. There would be sufficient funding to do two of these agency reviews.
Senator Tiedemann.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, just to give the rationale for my motion, one, that the Human Services Center would be a very, very small component that would be looked at. The Department of Health is not a large department when you look at the revenue, but a very critical department as we go forward, especially looking at immunizations for children and things of that nature and the impact that that would have. I can agree with Representative Abdallah that Bureau of Finance and Management needs to be looked at. I would ask that we save that for 1 year when we're done with all of the stimulus money. Remember, we still have about $38 million in stimulus money within the budget this coming year. And when that is done, then we can talk about how that was tracked and where we're sitting with all of that, and to make sure that our commitments are done. That's the only reason for my rationale. Thank you.
Good point. Further comments? All right, we have a motion and a second before the committee that the agency for review during the 2012 interim is the Department of Health Human Services Center.
It's actually two.
Yeah, the Human Services Center and the Department of Health. All right. Any further questions or comments? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
So I can show we have one no. Are there any other recommendations for agency reviews during the 2012 interim? Hearing none. We have that one. We're now down to subcommittee reports. Interns. Yes, Senator Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The subcommittee on interns met this morning with staff. The process for soliciting interns and accepting their applications is complete. We have 36 intern applicants this year. Staff briefly reviewed last year's assessment. Actually got very good reviews from both the legislators and from the interns. I think everyone seemed to be in agreement that we had a good crop of interns last year. And so it seems like they were happy, and so were we. I'll go briefly through the list of where the intern applicants are applying from, which universities. Augustana 2, Black Hills State 4, Dakota Wesleyan 1, Mount Marty 2, Northern State 5, School of Mines 1, South Dakota State 9, USD 11, and one out of state school. The process will be that interviews, now that the redistricting is done, interviews are going to be conducted with these candidates this week and next week, and they hope by mid-November
to have sorted through those candidates, and then we'll discuss it with legislative leadership, who makes the final appointments of interns for the next session. Of those of the applicants, 20 are Republican, 11 Democrat, and 5 Independent. Understanding, of course, that interns are appointed on a partisan basis. Currently, by action of this board, 19 interns are authorized, and they would be apportioned to the legislature as follows: Senate Republicans 6, House Republicans 8, Senate Democrats 2, and House Democrats 3. So that's the. Oh, I could also advise you that again, there are 36 applicants this year. Last year there were 33. The previous year 45. Previous year 31, and then 34. So we're actually probably up a little bit over the last few years in the number of applicants. Again, we haven't interviewed these people, but preliminary looking at some of the applications, it looks like there will be a good crop of intern applicants, and that the interviews will go fine. So that's the report of the interim committee, and then I'll discuss the item that I added to the agenda when we're ready. Thank you.
Okay. Any questions? Comments? All right. Do you want to proceed?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I guess the reason that I put the addition to the agenda to talk about increasing the number or changing the number of interns. Again, last year we had 22 interns. At a previous meeting, for budgetary reasons, we reduced that number to 19. For information, interns cost between $4,000 and $5,000 each. That's the what we end up expending from our budget for interns. Because we have at least a slight increase in intern applications, and it appears that it's quite possible that we may have plenty of good candidates. I'm suggesting that we consider changing our direction and authorize our legislative leaders to hire at least 19 and up to 22 interns, depending on the quality of the candidates that the interviews produce. And so, for discussion purposes, I'll make that as a motion and look forward to discussion on it.
Thank you. Is there a second to that motion? All right. Discussion. No one? All right. So when you say you're going to recommend that we authorize 19 and then allow possibly three more, would you rather that we change so that that we're authorizing 22, and Mr. Frey, do we have the funds for that?
Well, that's the $64 question, or in this case, the $12,000 question, is whether or not we could have the money to do that. It would depend on a couple of things: how much we spend, over and above what we have budgeted for other items, and how much money we really want to take away from the dues for 2012, because that's the only place where we have slack funds. One thing you could do, I suppose, is that, and it looked to me from reading the survey that $110 was perhaps adequate at this time for interns. And the reason we went to 125 was because we wanted to hold them harmless when we had to start withholding money for IRS purposes. If we went back to 110 for all of the interns, that would free up some money for an extra three, possibly, as well. So that's one way to get part of the money, and the rest of the money we will just have to search out. You know, if that's what you want to do. Obviously, we work for you, but it was one of the cuts. It's one of the ways that we got to our 10%, and it's a problem for us. But it'll come from somewhere else.
I think we'd leave leadership kind of in in a nowhere man land, because if we authorize 19, which we have done, and say, well, you can go to another 22, they're going to ask the same questions that I just asked, whether or not there's funding for that. And so I would, I would prefer that what we do is just say, either going to keep 19 or we go to 22, and then go ahead and we're if we go to the 22, we don't necessarily have the funding for them, but it's something that we could probably find later on. So, I think if we're going to do it, let's just make sure, let's pick a 19 or a 20, Senator Representative Abdullah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a substitute motion. Make it 22.
Is there a second?
Second.
Second by Senator Cutler. All right. So the substitute motion is that we go ahead and authorize leadership for 22 interns for the next legislative session. Senator Teason.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, first of all, I want to speak to the general subject of interns. And I think, and I know I've discussed this with some of my colleagues, that, we have... We're one of those states that has limited staff available, no individual staff for any legislators. We share LRC amongst all of us legislators. And I think, and different legislators use interns to different value, but I think there's a tremendous value when you think of an intern for less than $5,000 during the session. I think there's I'm not even talking about the value to the intern. I mean, obviously, there's something to be gained there as well. And we got 36 people that saw fit to apply for this job, and there's certainly some value in their spending time in the Capitol with us. But the value that we get, I just think it's good value for our money. Secondly, we are the legislature. It is our budget. And yes, obviously, if we spend another $12,000 or $15,000 for interns, then it's going to be our job to make sure that we've got enough money in our budget at the end of the year. And so we may have to, as we control our budget, so we may have to make some adjustments if we agree to do this. There's no doubt about it. This is money that we had not budgeted for. And secondly, to speak directly to the substitute motion, the only reason I did it the way I did it was we haven't interviewed these people, and so I'm not 100% confident that we have 22 great candidates. I think that we will, and I hope that we will, but I wanted to give the leadership some latitude if staff comes and says, hey, we talked to these people and we think there's we think there's 21 great ones, and I think we ought to, I think we ought to offer a position to 21 and go with that. So if we want to set it at a hard number of 22, fine, but I just thought it would be better to allow some leeway to those making the selection so they could pick according to the value of the people that they'd interviewed. Thank you.
Well, I think that if we authorize leadership 22 and they only find 20 that they feel are adequate, then that would be up to them to go ahead and just hire the 20. Now, the question I would have is on the pay, are we... Since we're going to the higher number, are we going to stay with the 125, or are we going back to the 110? Representative Abdullah.
Well, I know Representative Carson has something to say, but my motion to go to 22 was exactly that. Under the same conditions we're doing right now. Nothing was discussed. I didn't mention anything about the 125. It's 125. My motion is to leave it at that and just to go to 22. The argument against whether there's 22 being will be qualified is not an argument, because it's presently at 19, and who's to say there's 19 qualified?
True.
And they've hired 19 every year, so I don't think that's a valid argument.
All right. Representative Carson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's correct that we have a 35-day session. We're looking at reducing the money spent on interns from 125 to 110, or that's yet to be decided?
No, we'd set the pay at a previous meeting at 125, and I believe Representative Abdallah, as you just explained, increased number of interns from 19 to 22 with the rate being the same. Is that correct, Representative Abdallah?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
All right.
Second part of the question, Mr. Chairman, is we have no idea as of right now where that $12,000 to $15,000 is coming from? Other than we have to find it within our budget.
I believe that is how I understood the
thank you.
The director. Representative Abdallah.
Well, as Senator Teason alluded to, that legislator has a personal intern or a personal page or any of those people, and they serve all of legislators, 105 legislators, as we all know, and to have 22 interns seems to me that is reasonable. Now, I've sat on this board for 6 years, and I saw a hell of a lot more wasted money than $15,000 for three interns. I mean, just this morning, $840,000, not that it wasn't necessary, but they found that money. They found $840,000. I think we can find $15,000.
Further questions or comments? Representative Feinstein.
Mr. Chair, I am in favor of this amendment of increasing it, but Senator Teason raised an interesting question, said how people use interns different ways. I mean, I've never done this, but I've, you know, and I don't know if they've looked at what the interns do, but I get comments that some legislators are using interns to answer their email. Okay. Anyway, I just wonder that, you know, I'm just.
Okay. Representative, I don't think we want to get into the issues of how the interns are used. I would hope that, number one, I would hope that out of 36 applications, as we've got some of the best, I would assume we've got some of the best applications in the state of South Dakota, we would probably be able to find 30 that are qualified and would serve very well. So I don't think that the 19 or 22 is, I think we're going to find plenty for that. How they are used, you know, that's, I don't know. So far, all the interns that I have been associated with in the last 7 years have been used for proper issues for research, for helping leadership, and I would imagine, I would hope that they would continue doing that. Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I encourage the passage of the motion. I think that we should go to 22. I am not speaking for the subcommittee, just speaking for myself, but I think that sort of acted in haste last spring when we lowered the number and recommended to this board we do this because after further review and thinking of it, simply from a personal standpoint, the second year of a session, I think that interns get a lot more work simply because the freshman legislators, again, speaking for myself, my first year, I didn't use an intern all that much. Second year, I knew what they were there for, and I used them quite a bit. And I think that the workload is there a little bit better, and I think we should we can take a look at it again next spring, but I think the workload justifies the higher number, and I encourage passage of the number 22, please.
Thank you. Very well said. Any further questions or comments? All right. The motion before the executive board at this time is to increase the number of interns for this next legislative session to 22, and the pay will remain as we had previously raised it to $125. No further. Everyone understand? Fine. Secretary, please call the roll.
Aye.
Motion carries. We will now have 22 and they would be paid $125. I think that's an excellent change. I agree that we're going to be able to utilize them. So, is there anything else to be brought before this session of the executive board today? Anything else? Next meeting will be December 6th, in conjunction with the governor's budget report. Senator Cutler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm sorry, I should have probably done this earlier, but I just wanted to thank our staff, our LRC staff, over the summer. With money tight and everyone under pressure and a million things to do, to have undertaken some of the jobs that we gave them this summer with the limited resources that we had. I just want to publicly thank them for the hard work, particularly, you know, the work I was involved with had to do with the redistricting. And those were long, sometimes difficult meetings with a lot of reliance on staff to be not only travel, but come there with all of these different maps and be available to the public to explain the maps and get them posted out on the LRC website and get the meeting notices out. So I think that deserves a special thanks on behalf of all of us who worked on that.
Okay, as far as the December meeting, since everyone will be here in attendance for the governor's budget address, I would recommend that we start the meeting early in the morning so that we can be on our way like we are today, 11:45. So as we progress through the next 5 weeks and see how the agenda is looking, we'll send. Preliminary agendas out to you, but I would imagine that if we have subcommittees, they can meet at 8 o'clock, and the full executive board at 8:45. That is subject to change. Anything else to bring before the executive board today? Sure. Representative Abdullah, is there a second? Seconded from Representative Lucas. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Thank you.